The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from Westport, Connecticut today as I make my way up the East Coast. Was in Washington, D.C. last week for the Shackley Convention, learning about that green company. Been green since the inception back in 1955. That company is old as I am. In fact, having a birthday today. And what better thing to do on one's birthday, not take the day off, but interview one's favorite, most inspiring experts. And in that case, this is Richard Heinberg joining me for the first half of this hour. And then Joseph Rome. Both excellent experts in their own field, and there is some overlap, so perhaps Richard will stay on for a bit when we get Joe Rome on the show at the bottom of the hour. Richard Heinberg, in case you're not aware of him, he is one of the prophets, one of those who has been calling exactly what is unfolding economically, ecologically, energy-wise for many, many years, as long as I've been covering this beat, and I'm very pleased to have him on the program. He's just come out just a few days ago with his new book called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. It's kind of dark, it's not pretty, but it is reality, so better to understand it and if not embrace it, at least deal with it so we can be better equipped to go forward into the uncharted territory that is our future. It's not all bad. Lots of opportunities for positive change here. We're going to talk about that now with my friend Richard Heinberg. Thanks for joining me on the Green Front.
Well, it's a pleasure, Betsy. Good to be with you.
Yes, I think the last time we spoke on air was the end of the EcoTalk era on Air America about 4 years
ago. That's
right. I think
yeah.
You did my final show. Who knew it would take this long to get back on mainstream media, which still has yet to happen because, of course, 95% of all talk radio shows are hosted by those who would not have us believe that there's any problem with our climate, with our environment whatsoever. So they're blocking anything that would try to be a green show, but still working on that. In the meantime, thank goodness for places on the Internet like the Progressive Radio Network that values this very kind of forward-thinking and honest reporting and interviews that we do here and all the other shows as well on PRN.
Right. You're right. So, well, good for you.
Thank you. You know, we can't give up. Once we know what we know, there's not a lot of alternatives, right, other than to find outlets. I, too, am working on a book. Stay tuned for that. It's tentatively titled As the Glaciers Melt. And it's part humorous, part tragic, really, as I document the last 12 years of trying to bring green content to mainstream media and all the ups and downs therein. A special chapter devoted to our hero Al Gore, all the times I made Mecca to Nashville for the climate training, begged him to help save my show when it was on, only to be told for one reason or another that wasn't possible, with apologies. So that chapter will be Al Gore-rhythm. But let's talk about your book. The End of Growth, you say things are changing. We're not going to see a recovery like we have in the past. First of all, why is growth ending, and how do you define growth?
Well, I define growth as in terms of GDP, which is the way it's commonly defined, gross domestic product. It's just basically the total amount of money spent in the economy, and it's basically a marker for consumption. So as the economy grows, we consume more, and consumption, personal consumption, makes up about 70% of economic activity. So it's a pretty quick and dirty equation, but it's fairly accurate. And we've had economic growth for the past few decades pretty reliably. Of course, we had a bit of a hiccup back in the 1930s, but for the most part, we've had economic growth, and economists have come to think of it as the normal setting for the economy. And they believe that we can keep growing the economy essentially forever. But, of course, we live on a finite planet. We have limited resources. So the very idea that we can continue growing the economy for any substantial amount of time is pretty questionable just on its face.
I would agree, and yet hardly any major mainstream economists are telling it like you are at the Postcarbon Institute, which I should have mentioned at the top, where you're a senior fellow. And those of you who are getting word out about what we might be encountering, it's a very sobering presentation. I've heard it from some of your colleagues who have been on the show, Ken White and a couple of others. And it's a wake-up call, even to people like myself who like to think we're on top of things, dark as they may be at times. Tell us what the Postcarbon Institute, you know, is really trying to achieve with your reality check.
Well, you know, we are headed into a fundamental shift in our economy that very few people are prepared for, and certainly policymakers are not helping to prepare us for it. It has a lot to do with energy, but there are other dimensions to it. I say energy because energy is at the very heart of our economy. Economists tend to take energy for granted as just sort of one factor in production, but in the final analysis, everything depends on energy. Life itself depends on energy, and it's the energy of cheap fossil fuels that enabled this industrial growth period to happen in the first place. And now, as the era of fossil fuel starts to wind down, we're not running out of oil or gas or coal, but we are finishing off the low-hanging fruit and having to dig deeper, drill deeper, and produce lower quality resources that require increased investment. That's why we're paying, you know, $3, $3.50, $3.75 at the gas pump these days instead of a dollar, which is what the U.S. Department of Energy was forecasting only 10 years ago that we would be paying. So as this happens, it gradually undercuts other aspects of the economy, like the financial system, that have been built on the assumption of continued economic growth. And so over the course of the last 4 years, our financial system has gone into fibrillation. And most commentators look at that in isolation. They just look at factors within the financial economy and try to explain why we've built up so much debt and what the problem with that is, without connecting that also to factors in the real physical economy of energy and resources. So that's what we've tried to do in our work at Postcarbon Institute, is put resources and energy back into the economic picture and show why we have to rethink economics in a world of environmental limits.
So it's very important to provide the full context and not just compartmentalize what some see as, you know, separate problems, separate challenges.
Right.
That silo effect can be dangerous because, you know, there are so many who do, you know, predict economists and many members of the public, you know, Americans, just thinking this is just another recession. We're going to come out of this. And certainly with the lingering job, you know, unemployment rate, that's making, I think, people pause a little bit and say, wait a minute, maybe not quite so fast. But what you're saying is actually this is the end of growth as we know it, and that the recession that started in 07 and 08 was not only foreseeable and inevitable, as you say, but is really marking a permanent fundamental break from the past.
That's right.
Really.
That's right. We had a brief recovery, but we had to pay significantly for it. We purchased it at the cost of trillions in government debt that were used for stimulus packages, for bank bailouts and loan guarantees to banks and insurance companies. What I didn't really understand when I started writing this book, and I have come to understand since through long conversations with economists, former Wall Street insiders, and so on, is that there is a time bomb at the core of our economic system. And that's that our system relies so much on debt. We have a monetary system in which we create money. Banks create money by making loans. That means that every dollar in your pocket represents a dollar of debt somewhere within the system. So the only way the economy can grow is if debt grows. And if you look at a chart like I have in the book that's showing debt in recent decades, consumer debt, government debt, corporate debt, debt within the financial system, all of those categories have grown enormously. And that has been absolutely necessary to the growth of the economy. The time bomb at the core of the system is this. As debt grows, the proportion of income that is paid as interest also tends to grow. And so consumers have been taking on more and more debt through house mortgages and credit cards and car payments and so on. And now most American consumers are loaned up to their eyeballs. They can't take on more debt because interest payments are making up such a large proportion of their income. The same thing is happening with the federal government. As government debt balloons, then that makes interest payments on government debt a larger and larger percentage of government revenues. So we get to a kind of brick wall where the only way the system can grow is by blowing temporary bubbles like we had over the past decade, first with the tech sector, the internet bubble of the late 90s and early 2000s, and then of course the real estate bubble. And we are at the end of that road. There's no more growth to be had within the financial system, and then couple that with limits to the availability of energy and natural resources, and we get to a place where clearly the game is up. We have to adapt to an entirely different economic reality that really we should be thinking of as normal.
And when you talk about a bubble, I can't help but think of, you know, the very thin outline of a bubble, so vulnerable, so fragile, and thinking of Al Gore's climate presentation with the layer of atmosphere, you know, just so vulnerable, and what we're doing to this very precious bubble that we're all on called planet Earth.
Right.
One does not need to look beyond the past year to look at what happens when we really are pushing things to the brink with the perfect storm of tragedies, beginning with the coal mine disaster, showing the cost of, you know, continuing to send humans down under the earth to pull up ever more coal for us. I think 24, 29 coal miners lost their lives, followed immediately by the BP oil disaster, and then, of course, what happened in Japan. So aren't we, and if we're not, why aren't we feeling a little more vulnerable just to, you know, what we're doing to Mother Nature? And we should around now be sensing that we are, you know, we have a symbiotic relationship with the earth, and
right.
Best take care of our life support system or else.
Yeah, see, this is a third basket of factors that are crimping global growth. We talked about factors within the financial system, the debt time bomb, and the limits to resources. But there's this third basket of environmental impacts. With every passing year, we're setting records in terms of costs to society from natural disasters and industrial accidents. With natural disasters, well, these have been going on forever, you know, volcanoes and earthquakes and so on. So why should costs be mounting? Because we have more industrial infrastructure, more people in harm's way, larger human population, and also we're changing fundamental environmental systems, ecological systems. We're changing the climate, we're acidifying the oceans, we're depleting fish stocks within the oceans. All of these things are changing fundamental environmental factors that we rely on. So as we have floods and wildfires in record severity, it should come as no surprise because these are the result of our putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, changing the climate. And again, the costs are mounting. In 2010, it cost us about $220 billion cost to society from floods in Pakistan, droughts and fires in Russia, the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, and so on. Well, in 2011, that $220 billion mark was passed in June. So 2011 is on track to be by far the record year again for costs of natural disasters and industrial accidents. And you don't have to trace that trajectory out very far to get to a point where, again, virtually all economic growth within the system will be taken up in just paying for these kinds of disasters and accidents.
And exactly a year ago, we were talking about the, you know, record flooding in Pakistan and drought and fire in Russia, and yet one need not look beyond the national boundaries to look at what's happening here with floods in the nation's heartland and continuing drought and fires in the south and southwest and Texas still being you know, gripped by this drought and heat wave, so many states. And yet, the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, would be president, you know, while he's asking for emergency funding for the natural disasters, is still claiming that climate change is a problem we need not concern ourselves with. The political climate is most surprising, perhaps as shocking as what's happening to our natural climate.
Yeah, this is the reason that I wrote the book. It's not just to make people depressed that, you know, everything's going to hell. It's because we're not talking about the real problems, and there are opportunities to address these problems, but we'll never grasp those opportunities if we're in denial that these things are even happening in the first place. So we have everyone in Washington, you know, fretting about the national debt, but that's only a very, very small part of the total situation facing us, and most of the real a problem is in the area of depletion of natural resources and environmental impacts. They are really driving this economic crisis, and we're completely ignoring those.
Well, why? I know you're not a psychologist, you're many things, but one cannot help but speculate, you know, just the eco-sociology and psychology of the American culture. I know we're all about, you know, sense of abundance and entitlement and endless growth, ergo the name of your book, The End of Growth, but isn't this beyond even what you would have expected at this stage in our, you know, ecological history, given what's going on almost every day? There's some major weather event somewhere around the country, if not the world. And yet we have a crop of candidates in the Republican Party. I don't think any of them believe or will say that they believe that climate change is a real threat. So last thing they're going to do is make that a priority on their to-do list.
Right. We are living collectively in denial. There's no question about that. And, you know, it's a natural human response. I personally spend a lot of my time in denial. You know, it's hard to
spend
24 hours a day thinking about all of this stuff. You know, sometimes one just wants to turn on some music and zone out a bit. But the reality is that our human brains are wired in such a way as to reject certain kinds of news. And we need to evolve fast to get beyond that so we can internalize the bad news in a way that is functional. Many people hear about climate change, and if there's nothing they can immediately do about it, they just shut off. They either go into denial or they just, don't want to hear anymore.
Yeah, and then there's some of us who lose sleep endlessly, you know.
And there are others of us who have this capacity to think about our impact on future generations, and we really internalize that and take it to heart. Well, I think
perhaps we'd like to be in more denial, but it's not possible for some of us.
Yeah, right.
We wish they were right, if only.
Yeah, I think this is an evolutionary mechanism. You know, I think there's maybe 5% of the population that is sort of the growing tip, if you will, of the species, and we are kind of the adults in the room, and we're thinking about our impacts on the environment and the prospects of future generations, and it's really up to us to wake everybody else up however we can.
And while they try to kill the messengers, look what they tried to do to Al Gore, and the few times I've been on you know, sparring with Hannity on Fox News, I've gotten, well, 5 times, in fact, and each time I've gotten death threats, my goodness, for daring to suggest that man is part of nature and we best pay attention. I mean, what's that about?
Right, right.
Fear. It must be some kind of fear, reptilian fear of change.
Yeah, well, bless your heart for doing that. More of us have got to stick our necks out and take this message to our friends and neighbors. Not, you know, getting on media is important, writing letters to the editor of the newspaper, but just talking to our friends and neighbors in non-threatening ways, you know, not trying to beat them over the head with more data and reports and so on, but you know, really trying to get through, because, you know, there's so much at stake. Again, there are ways of getting through and around these challenges. And if we do, there could be a much better future waiting for us. But we're not going to get there just with denial.
Keeping our heads in the sand, yeah. And it's not so much about courage. It's, for me, it's just about, you know, frustration and anger and how dare they, you know, spew this garbage and challenge 98% of the world's climate scientists. So when they ask me to come on, I say, sure, instead of yelling at my TV, not that I watch it when I'm not on Fox News, that is. you know, say it on set. Maybe we can, I'd like to start a campaign. It's in fact part of my America's Green Tea Party campaign I just launched. One of the goals is to get Sean Hannity off set, or anyone who dares sit there night in, night out, and say, you know, that it's a hoax, an Al Gore hoax. I mean, this has gone on for long enough, and it does make one angry that, given what you say, so much is at stake, just about everything is at stake when you're talking about the planet. Just about everything anyone cares about has happened on this planet Earth. And not to be overly dramatic, but given the rapidity and the ferocity and velocity of the weather events we're seeing, we should be alarmed. There should be a sense of urgency. And yet, you turn on the television and you don't hear climate change or energy issues being discussed by the current crop of would-be candidates. And we can only hope that President Obama, if he is reelected, will make these issues a higher priority now that he's gotten health care reform and the economy out of the way for now. But something tells me it's not going to be that simple again. And one wonders what will it take to get the political will that, you know, one would have thought might have come after Al Gore's and Convenient Truth came out. That was 5 years ago. It seems like we've degressed in some ways, regressed.
Yeah, we need a national conversation about what really matters, and we need a conversation that's not polarizing. It's probably the greatest tragedy in our history as a nation that we have taken simple facts about what's happening in our economy and in our environment and turn them into political discussions that are so highly polarized that make it impossible for us to actually do anything. So that's another reason for us to talk again to our friends, neighbors, and relatives about these issues in a way that's not threatening and where we can actually find common ground.
Exactly what we're doing with the Green Tea Parties or House Parties, and we talk about 10 ways to green your routine, and we have a liaison from the Citizens Climate Lobby, and they're pushing for fees and dividends as opposed to cap and trade, talking about one, you know, win-win solution, at least something that looks like it just could work, to give people a sense of, you know, empowerment and impacting their house to the House, Congress, and the White House. And we're also saying, you know, go to the League of Conservation Voters Environmental Scorecard to check out your candidate's track record on the environment. And do you think, given these urgent issues, that we dare elect anybody who doesn't understand what's really going on? And
right.
We only hope we can spread fast and far enough in the next year to make a difference. But you would think, given this environmental climate, that any candidate who was on top of these issues, or at least talking about them, acknowledging they exist, would have a, you know, advantage, a strategic advantage. In fact, you know, it's treated sometimes like just the opposite, which is, again, mind-boggling. But not to dwell on that, hope you think that's a good idea, though, because I do think it's face-to-face talking with our neighbors and our community members that really does cause a change when we don't feel so alone in our sense of, you know, this is surreal, you know, what we're seeing happening. And people do seem to respond well just in our first couple of parties just to say, yeah, I feel helpless and powerless, and I don't like feeling that way, and I have children in this world, and what can we do? And there's no simple solutions, but what would you say, Richard Heinberg, since you are the expert, I've got you here, you know, how can we, you know, slow consumption or have responsible consumption, if that's possible, continue to have a strong economy, and yet, you know, not be over-consuming?
Right. Well, we've reached, as I argue in the book, we've reached the end of a certain way of organizing the economy around debt and growth. And we haven't prepared ourselves for this transition, so it's going to be a jarring one. We are in store for some hard economic times. There's just no getting around that. However, it's not the end of the world. We've been through hard times before. We had a Great Depression in the 1930s. And a lot of people actually who went through that experience looked back on it with some sense that, you know, it called forth the best in a lot of people. There wasn't a lot of money to go around, so people had to do with less, and they had to find ways of cooperating and sharing more. That's what we're going to have to do in the years ahead. We're going to have to cooperate more and share more, and it would really help if we got off of GDP, because GDP is just a measure of how much we're consuming, and if we're always aiming for and promising GDP growth and we can't deliver on it anymore, then it's going to be a very frustrating experience. On the other hand, if we were measuring and aiming for and promising improvements in quality of life, we could achieve that without increasing consumption. And there's a lot of data to back that up. Lots of examples could be given. Alternative indexes have been proposed for many years. Robert F. Kennedy, back in 1968, gave a memorable speech in which he questioned the use of GNP at that time, what's called GDP today, and talked about how we need to be measuring and aiming for improvements in the integrity of our environment and the quality of our community life, the quality of our education and healthcare. Some of these things do require more investment, but they don't require more consumption of natural resources for the most part. And that's the key. We have to make human society and the human economy fit within the budget of nature. And we can do that, but not if we insist on continually growing the GDP.
And, you know, Americans are world-class shoppers. We shop for sport. You know, what happens when we no longer just keep buying, you know, clothes and cars and computers, whether we need to replace them or not, or add to our, you know, overstuffed closets? And now, you know, the biggest growth, one of the biggest growth industries is storage units, you know, for all our
right.
stuff. Is it possible to you know, survive and thrive as a country if we're not shopping for sport, for lack of a better way to describe it, but that really is almost what it is.
Right. We created the consumer society over the course of the 20th century because of overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make so much stuff. We created the advertising industry and consumer credit industry to help people consume more, and we made that the measure of happiness. But consuming doesn't make us happy. In fact, cross-cultural psychological studies over the past couple of decades have shown consistently that in many countries where people consume much less, people are just as happy or even happier than we are in the highly industrialized West. It's because they aim for other cultural experiences in their lives. They find ways of spending more time with their families and with their communities, talking to their friends. These are things that actually make us happy rather than spending time with our machines and gadgets and cars and so on that we spend so much time working to pay for and then paying the interest on our credit card debt. It's a rat race, and it's driving us crazy.
And making us sick, just to, you know, mention just the stress factor, you know, causing, you know, increased illness and cancer. I've heard since we just did it this summer, we downsized. We moved to a smaller house renting so we can save some money, not to buy more stuff, but to try to just sustain whatever is to come. And since I've mentioned that to a few friends, they said, oh, my gosh, I've heard so many people who are doing that, you know.
Right.
You can't quite handle the mortgage, or you don't want to be spending so much on your mortgage, not knowing what's going to happen to real estate value.
Well, see, that's the sensible thing to do. Borrow less, consume less, downsize, lower expectations.
Get rid of the debt.
You know, get out of debt. But the thing is, if everybody did that, that would cause the economy to contract. And so we're not encouraged to do these sensible things, these reasonable responses to what we see going on in the economy, because if everybody did these reasonable things, then the economy would contract even further. That's the contradiction at the heart of this economic model that we're living in. And the problem is not people. The problem is not that we're doing the wrong things. Most people's instincts are actually right on. The problem is the economic model.
And you know, like you said, we're not happier than many other cultures. And in fact, another area of growth is antidepressants. And you know, kind of joking, but quite seriously, people are feeling like we're just out of whack and just out of touch with what's really going on, and so we anesthetize ourselves. And so there's so many opportunities. There could be sort of silver linings or green linings in these multiple crises we're facing, but only if we navigate it well. You know, otherwise it could be just disastrous for so many people, which is kind of how it feels like we're going now.
Right.
If you were president, Mr. Hineberg, I'd vote for you. What do you want to see happen? How would you advise us to sort of maneuver these treacherous waters and
yeah.
our political system, our institutions?
There's several things that would need to be done right away. I mentioned one, getting off of GDP. And that could be done pretty rapidly, actually. But then, of course, it would have knock-on effects all through the economic system. Another thing would be to tax purely financial transactions and use the, you know, in the world we trade currencies to the tune of $4 trillion a day. Even a 1% tax on currency transactions, currency trades that don't really benefit society at all, and in many ways actually undermine society. If we downsize the financial industry and use the proceeds to support the real economy of real people working and producing real stuff, that would be a good step. Promoting localization of agriculture, better public transportation, all of these things would be necessary to the adaptation to a future with more expensive energy and less fossil fuels. And then promoting a jobs program in the energy transition to renewable energy sources. These are all things that I think most Americans would immediately agree with if they thought about them for even a minute. But our policymakers aren't even offering them as options.
Richard, you've written several other books. Are you getting a stronger reception to this one? Not that there was anything lacking from your first couple, but are more people, you know, receptive? Is the message more receptive because we're starting to see that exactly what you doomsayers had predicted is, in fact, coming?
Yeah, well, you know, I think more people are starting to realize that something is going on here that is not being captured in the headlines or by the politicians and pundits, that something fundamental is shifting in our world, and they don't have words really for it. They don't have concepts for it. But what I've tried to do in the book is outline the larger historical process that we're in. I spoke to a couple of dozen world experts, not only on resources, but also some former Wall Street insiders who helped me understand how the debt time bomb got inserted into our economy and what it means for us. And yes, I think it is stoking a conversation, a new national conversation around the economy. And I'm glad to see that happening.
And I'm glad you have this book out, The End of Growth. Richard, we've come to the end of the segment, but if you can stay with us, we have Joseph Rome, I think, on the line, and we're going to take a quick break, come back. Perhaps you'd like to add to that conversation. You both are among my favorite thinkers and speakers. You tell it like it is. You're bold.
Yeah, well,
you're
thank
brilliant.
You. I don't want to take time away from Joe, but I'd be happy to hear what he has to say and chime in from time to time.
Great. Stand by, then. We'll keep you on the line. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Green Front, and this is a live show from Westport, Connecticut. I'm in the woods here celebrating my birthday. I won't say which one because it doesn't quite compute to me, but I feel inspired and enthused and impassioned by the interviews that I get to do on this program, and thank you to the Progressive Radio Network for making it possible. Stay with us. I promise the next half hour is going to be just as compelling as the first, and we'll keep Richard Heinberg on with us. Be right back.